Hello, everyone. Welcome to this last International Inequalities Seminar of the Lent Term at LSE. I'm Chico Ferreira. I'm chairing today's event. It's a great pleasure to welcome François Bourguignon, who probably needs no introduction. But in any case, François is an emeritus professor of economics at the Paris School of Economics, a former director of the Paris School of Economics and one of its co-founders, former chief economist of the World Bank, and probably one of the four or five people who shaped the way the modern way we look at inequality in economics, along with the likes of Tony Atkinson and Amartya Sen. So François is a hugely influential economist in our field, and we're delighted to have him with us today. He's going to be talking today about anonymous and non-anonymous growth incidence curves in the US. Just before I hand over to him, let me do the usual announcements of further events, plugs of further events to come. We have Easter break coming up, but then on Monday, the 26th of April, we'll have Debating Capital and Ideology with a panel featuring another eminent PSE economist, Thomas Piketty. On 28th of April, we'll have a session on Mary Wollstonecraft and the Vindication of Human Rights with Professor Amartya Sen and writer B. Rowlett, looking at justice and equality. The details for both of those are in the chat right now. We have 1 hour for our event, as usual, so François will speak for about 40 to 45 minutes. It's a joint paper, I should say, with Jonathan Behrman, and we also have the pleasure of having him with us on the call today. When we come to Q&A, if you could just either raise your hand or send me a quick note in the chat, I'll turn to you for your questions. Now, without further ado, François, thanks very much. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Chico. Normal times, I would say, this would be in person, and I would say how happy I am to be at LSE, and because I've not been there and I've not been giving a seminar for quite some time now. But things are as they are, and this is much better than nothing in any case. So this is a joint paper with Jonathan Behrman, who is with us, and I'm happy that he's attending, because probably some question will be he will be the only one able to answer a couple of questions. And I should also say immediately that this is still work in progress. We have been working on this for quite some time, but we seem to have a bit of difficulty converging toward the final version of this paper, which is, as you will see, touching on different issues. So let me go, because we don't have very much time, I will try to be quick. So this paper is really a paper which is at the same time on empirics, but maybe more, little more about technical issues or methodological issues. The basic idea is really to compare, to understand what is the kind of difference that we have between an anonymous growth incidence curve and a non-anonymous growth incidence curve. So very, very close concepts, but which, a bit surprisingly, leads to different conclusions. So let me first define what we call a growth incidence curve. This is now a very standard concept in the analysis of growth, welfare analysis of growth. Basically, the growth incidence curve shows the rate of growth of income at a given quintile of the distribution. So we look at people who are at the 10th decile in the eighth decile, and we look at the way in which the income of those people has grown between time t and time t prime. Now, what is important here is that it is, so typically we could say that the bottom decile has gained X percent, whereas the top decile gained Y percent. The main point here is that we are assuming that we are looking at two cross-sections of people, and we're assuming that people who are in a given decile are to some extent completely comparable or as the same at time t and at time t prime. So we don't care to some extent about the identity of the people who are in a given decile at the two points of time, which is equivalent to assuming that they are the same. And of course, this is a problem. It's kind of a veil of ignorance about the identity of those people, and we are, in terms of the dynamics of income, we are certainly missing something, because we are not observing the mobility of individual income between time t and time t prime. Now, there is a very important property of this gross incidence curve, which is easily understood, which is the fact that if this curve is downward sloping, then this is equivalent to say that the poor people are, their income is growing faster than rich people. And this directly implies that the Lorentz curve, which is a key indicator of inequality, is shifting upward, which would mean that inequality is improving, whatever the criterion that we are using. There is an unambiguous improvement in the income distribution, which is a nice property, but caution, because the opposite is not completely true. This goes in one direction, not in the other direction. By contrast, what is the non-anonymous gross incidence curve? It is not based on two cross-sections, it is based on panel data. So we're observing the same people at time t and at time t prime. And we are looking at people who are in a given decile at time t, initial decile at time t, and we are defining the non-anonymous gross incidence curve as the growth rate of income of people who were at quantile p at time t. Now, at time t prime, they may be in other quantile. Their rank has changed. And this is precisely the way in which non-anonymous gross incidence curve take into account mobility. So the same individuals are compared. This is the reason why we have something which is non-anonymous. If there were absolutely no re-ranking of people between time t and time t prime, then of course the NAGIC, the non-anonymous, would be exactly the same thing as the gross incidence curve, which means that the difference between the gross incidence curve and the anonymous and the non-anonymous is income mobility. And this was a point that was really put forward by Gary Fields in 2000. Now, there is an issue about what is the meaning now for a non-anonymous gross incidence curve of being downward sloping. We have seen that in the case of the gross anonymous gross incidence curve, this had an implication in terms of social welfare. Here we could say that social welfare is improving if we assume, and there is a question mark on this, that a given growth rate of income is socially more valuable for lower incomes. There is some argument in favor of that, but there are also counter arguments. Again, that. So it is certainly not as easy to interpret the downward sloping shape of the non-anonymous gross incidence curve in the same way as for the anonymous one. On the other hand, and this is also true for the gross incidence curve, what is the meaning of downward sloping? Assume that you define the P, P in a very precise manner. So you have, you look at NAGIC almost person by person. Then there is very unlikely that people will be ranked in such an order that the growth rate is going down. So we will observe a lot of fluctuation. So the meaning of downward sloopiness, of downward slope in that curve is something which needs to be discussed, and we'll do it later. Now, the basic question is, if we put them together on a standard database, and here this is the panel data in the US called PSID, which is which has been running for a very long time, since 67 until now. Now let's look at what we get when we look at this panel data. The 10-year period, 1980-1990, labor incomes only, so employed people only. These are the two curves that we get. We see immediately that, to be precise, the non-anonymous, by definition, is based on the cross-section in 1980 in the panel and the cross-section in 1990 in the panel. We don't take into account the fact that these are the same people. We do as if there were different people. And this is the blue curve, and it is increasing, which suggests that inequality, as a matter of fact, is increasing, which we know it was the case. The black curve is a non-anonymous one. It takes into account the fact that these are the same people at the beginning and at the end, and you see that it is downward sloping. So what we try to analyze in this paper is, why do we have different shapes? And what can we say about what the meaning, the welfare, social welfare implication of this? And the why different shape will not be a very easy question to answer. This is the 4 points that I would like to take up. First, the downward sloping biases that do exist and may explain why the non-anonymous, the NAGICs, let's call them like that, are very often observed as being downward sloping. Why it is the case, and the kind of correction that we can bring into this for these biases. Second point, I would like to propose a decomposition of the NAGIC into two parts, which precisely will put into evidence the role that the JIC, or the role that the change in the cross-sectional distribution plays, and the role that mobility plays. Is it possible to isolate those two effects and see in that way why we move from an upward sloping curve to a downward sloping curve? Third point is that in order to do that, and working with the PSID, we'll find that there are some difficulties, some obstacles in pushing the decomposition methodology that will be proposed with those data. And it is easier and to some extent equivalent to use a synthetic panel, which will provide some advantage and explain why in a moment. And finally, if I have time, I would like to say something about the social welfare properties and a generalized proportionality criterion. But this is maybe still work in progress, and maybe I will not be able to get there. Okay, first, this downward sloping bias in observed NAGIC. Why do we have that? First, we don't have it always. I mean, if we look at a given country at different time periods, it is downward sloping in some period, it may not be all the time. So we should not be systematic and say that whatever the period, we have this downward slope of the NAGIC. So this is simply a remark. A very important factor is the life cycle bias. If I have young people who in general will be poorer, whose income is growing faster than when people are older, then I have a reason to expect that the poor people will have a higher growth rate of their income over time, the same people. And I have exactly the opposite for older people. When they are approaching retirement, We know that labor income will be going down, maybe not very fast, but they will go down. And then we'll have a very good reason why the nudging is done what's looking. We have movements in and out of employment. And if we take into account people who are working part-time, moving from part-time to full-time, again, we have some instability in terms of labor supply, which may be the reason why we observe this kind of mobility when moving, and especially this is linked to young people probably, or secondary workers probably. And we would like to probably to correct for this. And then there is a very well-known income measurement error. If we observe, we know that in intergenerational mobility analysis, we know that the fact that we observe the income of the parents with error is introducing a so-called attenuation bias in the correlation between the income of the parents and the income of the sons or the children. We have exactly the same problem here. If somebody is in the lower part of the distribution of income at one point of time because there was a measurement error, and if there is not too much autocorrelation of this measurement error over time, in the next period, this person will be up. So because of that, there will be a tendency for people at the bottom to have a high growth rate simply because their income was badly measured or had a negative bias in the initial period. And of course, we have exactly the opposite when we look at people who are at the top. So these are, and we know that those measurement errors are maybe quite substantial. And in a well-known paper, Fields and Associates, working on panel data, analyzed very precisely the kind of error that and the impact of this. Okay, so what can we say about this when we try to make correction for the main points that I just mentioned? On this chart here, we're looking at the PSID sample. On this chart, we have all people between 20 and 55. And we are looking at the labor income between 2006, 2016. Same thing, the blue curve is the anonymous, the black curve is non-anonymous. And we observe that one is upward sloping, the other one is downward sloping. Now, if we look at the people who are working full-time only, then we see that immediately the two curves get flatter. So somehow, and if we look especially into the NAGIC, we see that we have gotten rid of a source of mobility that we may not want to take into account. This is debatable. I mean, we may want to take into account the fact that part of income mobility is the fact that people are getting in and out of full employment or full-time employment. But here, we're assuming that we're basically looking more at the mobility in terms of wage rate, which means that we are looking at full-time people. Now, in order to correct for the measurement error, we will be doing the standard method, which is to average over time. So instead of looking at income in 2006, we look at the average income over a three-year period with centered at 2006. And same thing for 2016. And when we do that, we see that when we look at all people 20 to 25, 55, sorry, then again, the NAGIC is getting much flatter. And now when we look at people who are working full-time, now we have a curve which is, at least with this scale, almost flat. Now, but you have to recall that the scale is very wide. So if we were to look at, to zoom on something around between 0 and 20%, we would find that the curve is downward sloping. But this shows the kind of difference that this measurement error can make. Instead of looking at the non-anonymous gross incidence curve, and this is a point which will become extremely important in just a moment, we could look at the correlation, rank correlation coefficient, which are on this chart, the rho sub s is the rank correlation coefficient corresponding to the various samples or the various methods. And you see that, as could be expected, when we move toward the when we correct for measurement error, then the rho s is increasing very much. We move from 0.58 on the left and upward to 0.83 when we look at the average income between for people between 35 and 40. Instead of doing that, let's look at this rho s exactly. And here we have the impact of the averaging. So what we have here is therefore various age groups in the PSID sample and various initial year. So one point on this chart shows the rank correlation coefficient over a 10-year period for people who have been observed in 1970, 1971, 1972, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, it is a moving window of 10-year period. And for each point, we look at the correlation coefficient over a 10-year period. On the left-hand side, you have the what is observed with no averaging. And on the right-hand side, you have the consequences of averaging. All the curves are moving upward. And you see that most of the curves are becoming much more regular. And we see that for every curve, we have an interval of variation which is rather reduced, which is, let's say, 0.1 or at most 0.2. But so the impact of the averaging is absolutely considerable. So this is a kind of counterpart of this is a mobility part of the panel. I'll come back to that in just a moment. Now let me now move to the second point, which is the decomposition methodology. To start with and to get an intuition of what is going on, let's look at the log normal case. Let's say that the distribution of income at time t and t prime is a joint log normal distribution. Now, doing a bit of calculation, we can show that the growth rate, I mean, the net g corresponding to that case is given by this formula where the mu's are the mean income or the mean log income at time t and t prime. Sigma t and sigma t prime are the standard deviation of the log income at t and t prime. Rho, which would be rho sub s, no, rho, which is really the correlation coefficient this time, is the standard correlation coefficient of binomial. And ERF is the standard error function. And here we can see that immediately we have the shape of the net g. If this expression here is positive, then the net g will be increasing. If it is negative, the net g will be decreasing. Which is interesting because at the same time we see that if we compare sigma t and sigma t prime, if sigma t prime is above sigma t, this means that the inequality is increasing, which probably, I mean, with the log normal, it is certain, will imply that the growth, anonymous growth incidence curve will be increasing. Inequality will be increasing. And vice versa, if sigma t prime is less than sigma t. So we have this interesting property here that if we look at this expression, the net g is increasing if rho is larger than that, than this ratio of the standard deviation, which is quite interesting because it shows that rho is mobility. And sigma t over sigma t prime is a change in the cross-sectional change in inequality. We see here the so the substance of the problem, mobility, cross-sectional change in inequality. Now, if the non-anonymous growth in Zinnetkov is increasing, this means that this expression, this inequality is true. But because the rho is less than one, as any correlation coefficient, this means that sigma t over sigma t prime is less than one. And we can say that if the net jig is increasing, then the jig must be increasing. And we have the opposite property, saying that if the jig is decreasing, then the net jig is decreasing. But we don't have an equivalent in the sense that if the jig is increasing, this has no implication on the net jig, and vice versa, if the net jig is decreasing, this has no implication for the jig. So this example with the log normal is interesting because it gives an intuition of the relationship between the anonymous and the non-anonymous. And at the same time, it shows that things are slightly more complicated than standard implication in one direction or the other. But now let's look at the general case. The general case will be based on a representation of the net jig, which relies on the copula. So the copula is basically the joint distribution of ranks in a joint distribution. So the rank at time t and rank at time t prime, or p, p prime, is that joint distribution of the ranks. And if we call f sub t and f sub t prime the marginal CDF of the income distribution at time t and at time t prime, then the net jig is given by this formula. You see that ft minus 1 of p is a quantile of order p at time t. And when we look at this thing here, we have the expected income of those people who were initially in rank p. At time t prime, they will be at p prime with a probability which is given by rp p prime. Then they will have an income which will correspond to the quantile p prime at time t prime. And we have to look at the expected value of all this. So this is the integral that we have here, simply the expected value at time t prime of all the people who were at were ranked p at time t. And if we divide by the quantile p order at time t, we have the growth rate. So this is the standard or very handy definition of the non-anonymous growth incidence curve. The interest, again, as in the log normal case, being that we are making a distinction between mobility, which is the copula, and the two cross-sectional distributions, Ft and Ft prime. Now, we will be using not the Ft minus one, it is a bit too heavy. So we can rewrite the above expression, replacing the inverse of the CDF by the yt, y tau p, which is a quantile of order p at time tau. And this is what we get. Now, if we look at this last expression, introducing a very simple arithmetic step, we can get a very interesting decomposition, which is the following. First, an issue of notation. I'm calling yr t prime of p and x the following. This is the expected value of the income of somebody rank p at time t prime, when the distribution of income at time t prime is given by this x of p. So if I arbitrarily decide that at time t prime, the distribution is x of p, knowing the rank mobility, I'm able to look at, to determine with this expression, the expected income of those people who were initially ranked P. Now, I'm applying this to the initial definition of the NAGIC that we had in the previous slide. And we get this decomposition. And this decomposition is easy to understand. What we have here is exactly the expected income of people who were ranked P at time T prime, knowing that the expected value is defined on the distribution of income at time T prime, that is observed at time T prime. So this is exactly what we had initially in the definition of the NAGIC. Right here, we have the initial income of people ranked P at time T. And we're introducing this element here, which is a bit odd, but you understand exactly what it is. What is this? This is the expected income of people ranked P at time T if the distribution of income at time T prime were exactly the same as at time T. So what is this? This is a pure re-ranking. R, the copula, is telling us that people are moving from one rank to another, but the distribution are the same. So they are moving from one level of income to another level of income with the same distribution. So what is interesting here, that this term here is stands only for the mobility, permutation of people. And this term here stands for the change in the distribution. You see that those two expressions are almost the same, except that here we are looking at the expected value at time t prime if the distribution was the same as in time t, and here the distribution at time t prime given the distribution observed at time t prime. So this is almost the gross incidence curve. The difference that we have here is basically the fact that we're changing the distribution. We're comparing the initial distribution with the terminal distribution.
Derrière la plaque.
Oui.
Hein?
Oui.
Et il faut faire sous les vies
du...
Pardon, il faut faire
sous les vies
de la laverie.
Il faut tourner
le truc de la laverie pour avoir le...
Oui, 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 oui. Excuse me, domestic problem. Sorry about this. Okay, so the point, what I was about to say, this is not exactly the gross, anonymous gross incidence curve, because there is a filter. You see that the filter is the fact that we go through the copula. We are looking not at distribution at time t versus distribution at time t prime. We are looking at the expected value of the people ranked p when the final distribution is that of t prime and when the final distribution is that of t. So there is a filter. We are, to some extent, smoothing the change in the distribution through the copula. So the mobility is playing really two roles. It is pure mobility here, and here it is changing or filtering the difference in income distribution between the two periods. So we find that this decomposition is an interesting one, looking at to my watch, okay. So let me maybe move quickly now. This is really an important point. Now, we would very much like to do that, to apply this decomposition on the PSID data, and in particular to the cases we just saw, when we were able to eliminate some sources of downward sloping bias in those data. So working, for example, on the 35-40 age group, full-time workers, etc. But then we have some difficulty. So first, we have to take into account the issue of measurement error. Is averaging the only solution? This is an issue that I will not answer that, but this is an issue to be, something, a question to be asked. there is an issue of granularity. When we define this copula, what is should we define the copula on deciles, on percentiles, on even smaller quantiles? This is not a trivial question, because if we define, for example, deciles, and we move people from a decile to another, then clearly when we look at the upper decile, the distribution of income within the upper decile is so broad that we cannot simply say that people with moving from one decile to another are to some extent homogeneous. We have to take into account the distribution within the decile. So there is an issue of granularity when we try to work with empirical copula. There is an issue of sample size. If the mobility analysis is on specific subpopulation, the sample size in standard panel data may prevent obtaining copulas or transition matrices with sufficient precision. In the case of full-time workers between 30 and 40 in the PSID sample, we have less than 400 people. Meaning that if we were to look or to work in terms in percentiles, we would have four people in a percentile. So no precision. And if we were to go to look at gender issues, the men versus women, ethnicity, et cetera, then it would be worse. So we have a problem here in the sense that it is not clear that based on standard panel data, we can use this kind of methodology. Now, situation would be very different if we had administrative panel data, when Kobzuk, Chetty, and all those people and Saez are working with millions of observations, then the situation would be different. However, it is not clear that they have all the covariates that we would like to use. And this is the reason why this is making a synthetic panel quite attractive. So let me, and I guess I will be finishing on this, explain to you why we do that. Instead of using an empirical copula, we can approximate the copula by a functional definition specification. There are many specifications available in the literature. It turns out that the Plaquett copula, which depends only on one coefficient, which is a rank correlation coefficient in the data, is a very good approximation of the true copula. This was already found by Bonhomme and Robin in the case of France, and it works very well with the US data. I don't have time really to give detail on those two transition matrices, but this is a PSID copula on the whole sample, 20 to 55, and this is the Plaquett copula, and if you have time or if you have access to the slides, you could check that they are very similar. So based on this, we have two elements which are interesting. The fact that the Plaquett copula is a rather good fit to the actual copula. And on the other hand, we have seen earlier that when we were correcting for measurement errors, rank correlations were rather stable over time for the different age groups. So based on this, we could say, okay, why don't we put together a synthetic panel using the rank correlation that we observe in the panel, possibly with some distribution, because we see that it is not constant, so we can take into account that there is a variation over time and there is some uncertainty about the precision of that coefficient. And on the other hand, use cross-sectional distributions, which are reliable and maybe even better than the cross-sectional distribution that we observe in the panel, because we know that there are biases, in particular attrition biases, in the panel. And this is what we do now. Moreover, when we look at alternative sources for cross-sectional distribution, in the US, this would be the current population survey, the CPS, which comes with 100,000 households. Then we have no problem of size. This facilitates very, very much working with subsamples. So one of the problems that I just mentioned with the PSID does disappear. So this is the interest of building synthetic panels that rely on bigger cross-sections at both ends, and which keeps the features of the mobility features of the panel data. So this is not a trick to invent something out of nothing. We are really using some mobility information taken from the panel, and we are enlarging or improving the cross-sections by using different sources. Okay, now I will not get into that. This is a, okay. If we are interested by synthetic panel, we'll discuss that later on. So the synthetic panel is done in this way. Okay, I'm not sure that I need to explain that. See, yes. So we use the Blackett copula with the correlation coefficient coming from PSID. We replace the marginal distributions by the data coming from the current population survey in the years we want to look at. As the rank correlation coefficient is estimated with imprecision, we draw alternative values in a distribution which corresponds to the estimation of that coefficient, so that we are not using a point estimate, we are using the whole distribution. And by doing that, we are really able to generate a confidence interval in the synthetic panel result that we will be looking at. And practically, this is true that the correlation coefficient is between 0.7 and 0.9. This is what we get when we apply that and compare it, I mean, to the PSID. So here, what we're doing, we are looking at the PSID, we are looking at the two cross-sections, and we're considering that they are not, I mean, they are two independent cross-sections. And we apply our methodology, our synthetic panel methodology, and we are comparing to the actual, the NADJIC obtained with the synthetic panel, with the NADJIC obtained with the genuine panel. And the blue is the synthetic, the black is the standard to a 10-year period. And you can see that, of course, the two curves are not exactly the same. But much more importantly, you can see that the confidence intervals overlap to a very large extent. So it's not clear that we're really losing anything by moving to a synthetic panel. Of course, the problem is to know later on whether conclusion that we can get from the synthetic panel will have a confidence interval which will be enough to for the conclusion to be significant or not. But we have to remember that even in the genuine panel, there is a lot of imprecision coming from the fact that there is a limited sample. So based on this, we could say that things are not too bad. This chart shows what we get with a synthetic panel by looking at very specific age groups and the different periods. And here, because we have a huge number of observations in the cross-sections, we can do that. And the implicit rank correlation coefficients are obtained by looking not at those very precise age group in the PSID, but slightly broader cohorts in the PSID. And again, here, what is interesting is the fact that we see evolution over time that we could not see with the PSID. The fact that the curves are changing, the NADJIC is a changing shape when we move from the young people to older people, and it's changing shape when we move from one period to another period. So here we have something which we find as a very interesting tool. And let me finish with this initial decomposition that we proposed, which we could not apply to the PSID. We apply now the decomposition to this synthetic panel for three periods. And this is what we get. So on these charts, the mobility effect is a green curve and the green area for the confidence interval. the shape of the distributional change effect is the purple curve. And the sum of both is the magic, the black curve. And you see that what we observe that the green curve is systematically downward sloping, whereas the purple curve, not systematically, but tends to be upward sloping, which corresponds to the idea that over this period, inequality increased in the US. And this is very well represented, of course, by the CPS data. And what we observe is that the NAGIC really is a combination of both. So because of the mobility term, the NAGIC tends to be downward sloping. But if you look at the middle chart, you see that the NAGIC becomes almost flat, basically because the shape effect or the distributional effect is much stronger. So this is interesting in the sense that we now understand, or we are now able to make the distinction in looking at the non-anonymous gross incidence curve, what is due to mobility, what is due to change in distribution, and to have some better view at what is really going on behind the downward slope of the non-anonymous NAGIC. And we believe that this is a quite interesting tool. And let me simply make one remark to end. I will not cover that, but the question is, what is the meaning of a downward sloping NAGIC? Okay, let's go back there. When we say that the black curve is downward sloping, this is certainly not the case. On the left-hand side at decile number 9, you see that you have an increase. So it is certainly not monotonically decreasing. And this, which means that the view that, I mean, that we should look at the slope and we should make conclusion in terms of inequality is not really satisfactory. And this is the reason why we try to go beyond the definition of the gross incidence curve or the property of upward sloping or downward sloping by defining what we call a non-monotonically decreasing curve or function, which is to say that the incomplete mean from zero is decreasing. And don't have time, but for those of you who know a little about dominance and inequality distributional comparisons, we recognize that we are getting close to Lorentz dominance and this kind of concept. Something which has been analyzed by some other people recently, in particular Palmisano, Peragine, Lobue, Van de Gark, and others. But let's stop here.
Thank you very much, François. That was really, really interesting. Let me open up for questions. I have a number that I could ask.
Sure.
Let me not abuse my use of the chair here. So, Stephen, please.
Hi, François. Nice to see you in your garden. Ha, background. And apologies for being late. I just wondered. I thought this was really interesting, and as you know, Philippe and I are really interested in this sort of thing. So, I guess my comment is, I'm sorry if I missed it, is how your NAGIC or magic results relate to the sorts of things that Philippe and I looked at in our OUP and Economica papers, because we try and do exactly the same sort of thing of going from, in effect, one Lorentz curve to another via a concentration curve. We've got indices decomposing changes in inequality into mobility and income growth and progressivity terms, and some pictures like the downward sloping graphs of the sort that you were showing. So I'd be intrigued to know what your thoughts about the relative differences between the approaches and the strengths and weaknesses.
Oh, basically, I would say that this is the same. We are doing something very, very similar in the sense that we are all trying to identify the mobility part, or to make a distinction between the mobility part and the change in the distribution. The only thing that instead of doing the kind of work that you've done with Philippe on which is completely related to dominance and you said, as you said it, concentration curves, etc. We do it in a rather descriptive statistical way rather than to get into the social welfare. I don't have time to get into social welfare discussions, which I think is quite interesting. As a matter of fact, we have a kind of unfinished paper, which is essentially on this, where we are trying to make exactly the kind of link or correspondence with what you did, what others did. But this is almost a different topic. What I presented today is more about describing the sources of the shape of the non-anonymous Grossman-Zielensky curve rather than. And of course, as you could see, the synthetic panel stories plays a rather big role, but a role that is different from what others have done on the with synthetic panel. I mean, the fact that we worked with copulas is changing a lot what we do with those synthetic.
Thank you.
Let me throw in one of my questions. First of all, talking about earlier work like Stephen did, I had a chapter in the OUP handbook of economic inequality a long time ago where I showed, amongst other things, you know, how changes in poverty measures and inequality measures and even just the growth rate could all be written as functions of the growth incidence curve. And at the end, I said, well, and there must be something like this between mobility and the non-anonymous growth incidence curve, but I can't figure out what it is. And you and Jonathan have now solved it. That the relationship is very clear and very nice. I wanted to ask two things. One, you're careful to sort of say that the shape, to call the shape term, not the growth incidence curve, but there is a relationship, right? And you, yeah. and you refer to it. And maybe I missed, you know, it would be interesting to see sort of exactly what the differences are between. So in some sense, I guess the idea would be to say, look, the non-anonymous growth incidence curve is the growth incidence curve plus mobility. Your decomposition has three parts, growth and the shape term and mobility. So is growth and the shape term together the growth incidence curve, the anonymous one?
No, not exactly. Okay, you have to take out the growth term. I mean, think about you are moving from one distribution to another one, but the mean income has not changed. And then you can add the fact that the mean income has changed and it is kind of a scaling up or down, and it's really very, very important. The reason why this shape term is not exactly the growth incidence curve, it is because it is, there is an intermediate, it goes through the, as I said during my presentation, that mobility is playing a role there. I call that a filtering in the sense that instead of comparing the distribution at time t and at time t prime as they are, I'm looking at the differences in those distributions when considering the mobility process. So
the copula.
Yeah, but I mean, intuitively, it's something a bit subtle. I'm looking at the expected value. People rank at some level in the initial period, depending on what will be the final distribution. So it is, of course, because they have some probability of being in various ranks in the final distribution. It is not the final. It is, you cannot look at the two distributions and say, this is the difference. There is a kind of expected, there is an expectation operator which has played a role in doing in comparing those two distributions.
It's almost as though the actual jig were a realization of the shape term in some sense.
Something like that, exactly. Exactly. Something like that. If you had no mobility, that would be exactly the gross incidence curve. With mobility, if you have perfect mobility, probably there would be no difference. Perfect mobility, same mean income, the shape term would disappear. So this is what the interesting thing is, that you cannot say that, as I said at the beginning, citing Gary Fields, you cannot say that NAGIC is jig plus mobility. It is jig combined with mobility plus mobility.
Interesting, very interesting. I have more questions, but I think Pavel has a question.
Thank you so much for this enlightening presentation. I just have one question. What would be the impact of migration on this non-anonymous growth incident curve? So I understand that it's probably, but it's of course not defined for migrants because we need to have as kind of the same person in these two periods. But let's say if there's an inflow of low-skilled migrants to a country or there's an outflow of those migrants, is it going to affect the growth incidence curve through the income mobility or through the shape parameter in this setup?
But I'm not sure about the, so you are referring to migrants who are entering the country at one point of time and will be staying there for at least 10 years?
Yeah. So of course, like migrants will not be, so if you think about non-anonymous curve, then of course they're not going to be at time t, let's say, they'll only be at time t prime, right? But then are they going to affect the distribution of income in t prime somehow? And then if so, through which channel?
Okay. I think the question is really raising an issue about the synthetic panel. In the synthetic panel, we have those migrants. Because when we're looking at the distribution of income in 1980 in the US and based on the current population survey, and in 1990, maybe there are migrants and there are people who left the country, who came in, who just came in the labor force. So it is not clear that the status of what you just mentioned is not clear, completely clear to me. Maybe not clear about the fact that, but maybe Jonathan has an answer to that.
I can see how this can, let's call it somehow mechanically, lead to potentially to a downward bias in some sense because of the typical waves of migration that you will see. So that if you have a migration wave in some year, probably by the end of it, by the end of the period that you're looking at, it makes sense that those people will be, let's say they will be lower paid in the beginning than in the later in the period, or even if they come, say, with a relatively high human capital, it might take it a while to influence their income. So in this sense, this might lead to this kind of downward sloping trend in the NAGIC. But I find it hard to believe that this will have a huge impact on the shape, you know, something that can explain a large part of the of the slope that we observe. Even if you have a period of 10 years in which you have, okay, maybe in countries in which migration waves are really tremendous, like Turkey in the past decade, say, even places like UK, I don't think it, for example, or the US, I don't think it.
I mean, in the context of US, I think a lot of commentators were kind of pointing to this explanation of this real wage stagnation since the 1970s, saying that the real wage hasn't changed since 1970s if you look at median worker. And I think one story was simply because was a huge inflow of low-skilled migrants, which would kind of populate the bottom of the distribution of income, and that would create the kind of lack of change in the real wages for the median. But of course, then someone said, okay, but if you look at a typical US worker, then you would see his income growing up in the same period. So, and I think there were some studies, trying to kind of show that this probably doesn't have a big effect, but I was just curious and how, could maybe somehow look at this question in your setup and whether this could possibly somehow be able to differentiate this, how these things kind of play out in your framework.
This is a work in progress. This discussion, question about the migrant is an interesting one, because this means that maybe I should have said more about the way in which we are using those cross-section data. Of course, we have to make sure that we are looking at the same population in the year T and year T prime. So from that point of view, we are not using the whole sample and the whole distribution. We are simulating a panel with those cross sections by making sure that the population is the same or is comparable. But the point on the migrants is a good point in the sense that maybe those people came in during the period, they have the right age, and there is nothing we can do. So true, okay, if migration is really big, this is a problem. But this is probably something that we should be able to check, because in the CPS data, the covariates are telling us something about where people were born, et cetera, et cetera. So this is something that can be taken care of. Now, to conclude on this, my point is simply that this is work in progress. There are two ways. I think that the decomposition by itself is an interesting tool, a descriptive tool, but which allows us to understand better what is due to change in the cross sections and what is due to mobility. And what is surprising is, surprised us, Yuatan and myself, is the fact that when you look at the evolution of this decomposition in the US, the role played by the increase in inequality in the US is enormous. And we tend to ignore it when we look at the non-anonymous, the panel data, when as a matter of fact, this is something which is quite important. So from that point of view, I believe that this is an interesting contribution. Maybe going back and forth between the PSID, the CPS, certainly, it might be interesting to use those administrative data that are available, if they were available to us, in order to maybe have more homogeneity in the data that we are looking at. So it is in that sense that the paper is not yet completely at the end of its gestation period.
Thanks very much for a very interesting talk. Now, there's only one plug I wanted to insist on, and I think it's something we touched upon in the Economica paper with Stephen, is using the cumulative growth incidence curve. And of course, it's related to orders of dominance. That's one aspect. But there's also an interest, an empirical interest, is that using cumulative growth incidence curves solves the problems of small samples and the trade-off between having percentiles and quantiles group, because by accumulating, you have the problem at the very bottom, but then you just have an increasing sample size based on which you can estimate everything, and you've got much more stable estimates, not have to worry about the width. And there are, I think, practical empirical advantages of considering the cumulative income. That's the only plug I wanted to make here.
And I fully, completely agree with you. And this is when I was right at the end, referring to this non-monotonically decreasing function was exactly that. The point is really to look at the incomplete mean, which is not exactly the same thing as looking at the growth rate of the cumulative bottom of the distribution. There are some subtle distinctions to be made there, but you're absolutely right. And this is a problem already with the gross incidence curve. I mean, the fact that the right concept is to use that the cumulative growth rate rather than to look at the growth rate. We fully agree on this.
François and Jonathan, thank you very much. This was a very, very nice talk. Thank you very much indeed. Happy Easter, everyone.
Happy Easter, bye-bye. Everyone. Bye-bye. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you.